You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
An array of hominids arose 6 to 7 million years ago, but only one of them, us, is around today. Ian Tattersall, a leader in human evolutionary studies and curator emeritus in the Division of Anthropology at the American Museum of Natural History, has written extensively on human and hominid evolution. I'm pleased to welcome him to our show to discuss his latest book, Masters of the Planet, The Search for Our Human Origins. It's published by Palgrave Macmillan. Thanks for coming. Welcome back.
Good afternoon.
Pleased to be here. At times I'm confused by the terminology. Human, hominid, non-human, hominid. Can you clear that up for me?
I wish I could easily clear that up with you. Unfortunately, there's no really good definition available of what human means. People have been referring to themselves as human since long before they knew there were apes, let alone that they knew they had close relatives in the fossil record. So that in fact, it's a very poorly defined term. The term hominid, on the other hand, is a very specific zoological term referring to the family to which we belong.
And then, so non-human hominid would be all the other hominids that aren't us, Homo sapiens.
That's exactly right, yes.
You say it's inaccurate to refer to early hominids as ape-like humans or just apes, but wasn't that the way they looked?
In a sense, they were, yes. The earliest hominids were upright, not in quite the same way that we are, but they walked when they were on the ground on two legs. But in other ways, they were very ape-like. They had small brains. They had very large faces relative to the rest of the skull, and they didn't walk upright in exactly the same way that we do.
Well, you mentioned the small brain's cranial capacity seems like an obvious place to find concrete differences between one species and another. What's the problem with using it as the marker for Homo sapiens and other Homo species?
Brain size is something that is very variable or varies very widely within our hominid family. The earliest hominids had brains about the same size relative to their bodies as apes do today. We have a brain that's three times larger, and indeed, we're the only hominid around today, so we're very struck by our large brains. But there are extinct relatives who had brains as large as we do.
Including Neanderthals.
Including the Neanderthals, especially, I think, the Neanderthals.
Haven't tool use and upright walking also been used to demarcate the various hominid genuses? Why has that theory been discarded?
The theory hasn't been discarded entirely. The sort of functional way of recognizing an early hominid actually is the ability to walk upright, at least when on the ground. The very early hominids had a lot of climbing capabilities as well, retained from their tree-living ancestry. But they did walk upright on two legs when they were on the ground. So functionally, the basic hominid adaptation is bipedality.
But then we have seen tool use in many species, yeah. Not just in the primates.
That's right. Today, we're finding out that more and more species do things that once upon a time only we thought we only did. But I think humans use tools in a very different way from other kinds of mammal.
Another demarcation was the way our thumbs work. Is that no longer being used?
The grasping hand is basically a primate adaptation, not just hominid, not even hominoid, including the apes, but primates in general have divergent thumbs and a grasping hand.
So we have to come up with new ways of explaining the differences. Apes share many similar behaviors with us, but they lack symbolic thought. Mm-hmm. That you say that's the major difference?
I think that is certainly the thing that makes us feel so different from everything else in the world.
And how can that be measured?
It's very, very difficult. The quality of intelligence is a very, very elusive thing to define. But on the other hand, it is very clear that we process information about the world around us in a very different way, in a sort of a qualitatively different way from any other species.
And you cite the mirror test as one way of determining this symbolic thought that we alone have?
Well, the mirror test, the ability to recognize that it is in fact your image that's reflected in a mirror, is not simply limited to human beings. Apes clearly are able to recognize themselves in mirrors, and there's even a suggestion that elephants can recognize their own image in mirrors. But that is a fairly a specific kind of intelligence, and it's not reflective of the generally broad kind of intelligence that we show.
So how do we know what our ancestors had or our hominid competitors had simply by looking at the archaeological record? You've done archaeological field work. Can you spot certain abilities simply by looking at a bunch of old bones?
Well, if you look at the bones and the teeth, which is basically what you have in the fossil record, it really doesn't get you very far, because the big criterion for sort of the history of hominid intelligence, if you were, is brain size. Hominids had sort of flatlined in brain size for the first few million years of their existence, not really getting bigger brains relative to their bodies than apes have.
And we could tell that by the size of the skull?
Exactly, by measuring the volume of the inside of the skull. And but at about 2 million years ago, everything changed, and the hominid brain sort of set off on a trajectory of enlargement, and it's really tripled in size in 2 million years.
So we mentioned earlier that Neanderthals actually had bigger brains than we do. What were they using them for?
Well, Neanderthals were pretty considerable creatures. There's no question about it. They were very sophisticated, probably in their day, which was between about 200,000 and 30,000 years ago, probably in their day the smartest creatures that had ever existed. But when you look at the archaeological record, which is, as opposed to the bones and teeth, the paleontological record, which is a record of their actual behavior, the record of the artifacts they made and the kind of lifestyle that they lived, you see that Neanderthals were, in fact, not a junior league version of ourselves as we have tended to view them, but in fact a very different kind of creature.
But they did make tools.
They did.
Did they make art?
They made very sophisticated tools, but they made them kind of in a rather stereotyped kind of a way. They didn't have kind of the technological inventiveness that's typical of Homo sapiens, and they didn't make art.
It seems that every few years we hear of new evidence that Neanderthals and Homo sapiens interbred, or that prove that they haven't interbred. Which scenario is more likely today?
Well, the very recent sequencing of a Neanderthal genome seemed to suggest that there was some minor level of interbreeding between Neanderthals and modern Homo sapiens at some point in their existences.
So we had to have been very close, because you can't interbreed with any species that is all that different from you.
Well, lions and tigers can interbreed, and they have been separated for many millions of years. So species are kind of leaky vessels, and I think what's important in this this scenario of interbreeding between Homo sapiens and Homo neanderthalensis is that basically the interbreeding that there might have been occasionally involving a very few individuals wasn't biologically significant. That is to say, it really didn't affect the future trajectory of either species.
But we share certain things. For example, Neanderthals buried their dead. I don't know whether they did that independently of Homo sapiens or whether we learned it from them or they learned it from us. And obviously you don't know.
Well, this is a very good point. Neanderthals certainly invented the custom of or the habit of burying their dead, at least occasionally, and always very simply. And human beings, according to the record that we have at present, actually didn't start burying their dead until after the Neanderthals had started doing it. But on the other hand, human burial is usually surrounded with ritual and the inclusion of grave goods and items that might be useful in an afterlife in the grave, and you find nothing like this among Neanderthals.
You discuss evidence from the El Cidron site in Spain that Neanderthals may have eaten each other. Well, but cannibalism isn't unknown among humans as well.
No, it isn't. But I think there is a difference in style. What is almost chilling about the Neanderthal and near-Neanderthal instances of cannibalism is it was very matter of fact. They were treating each other as food. And modern humans never do that. I mean, they may consume in a ritual fashion parts of each other, but it's always a special kind of behavior. It's not just a nutritional thing.
My guest is Ian Tattersall, curator of the Spitzer Hall of Human Origins at the American Museum of Natural History. His book, Masters of the Planet, The Search for Our Human Origins. Wasn't it thought until Jane Goodall did her field work that hominids were the only primates to be hunters and meat eaters?
That's true. And there's been an enormous amount of discovery about how sophisticated the chimpanzees are, for example, in many different ways besides the hunting. But hunting seems to have a different significance for chimpanzees than it does for humans. Again, it doesn't appear to be a nutritional thing for them so much as a social thing, and it's the sharing of the carcass that seems to be important. It's not really part of their economic lifestyle.
But we're both omnivores, although there are many who argue today that meat eating has serious negative health effects on humans.
Excuse me. Yes, it's true. But we are much more omnivores than chimpanzees are. For example, chimpanzees in the forest are basically fruit-eating forms, and when they live in a savanna environment away from the trees, they're still seeking fruit. What's extraordinary about the early hominids who moved away from the forest is that they changed their behavior, and they started exploiting different resources in a way in which chimpanzees don't.
Chimpanzees are opportunists when they eat, aren't they? I mean, a baby baboon is passing by, somebody grabs it, and suddenly we have a family feast. Well, would early humans have done the same sort of thing?
Well, I think chimpanzees do hunt, and they hunt in a sort of an adventitious kind of way, in the sense that it's really not part of their economic mainstay. The earliest human precursors who moved out of the forest started digging up tubers, and they started somehow exploiting carcasses in a way that chimpanzees just don't do, have not been seen to do.
Has a bigger brain size been linked to a higher meat diet in hominids?
The brain is a very energy-hungry organ, and it's the expensive thing to have a big brain. Our brains are only about 2% of our body weight, but they can consume up to 25% of all the calories.
My guest is Ian Tattersall. His book, Masters of the Planet, The Search for Our Human Origins, is published by Macmillan. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Ian Tattersall, who is, among other things, curator of the Spitzer Hall of Human Origins at the American Museum of Natural History, author of many books, the most recent, Masters of the Planet, The Search for Our Human Origins, published by Macmillan. Unlike humans, chimpanzees and other apes reach maturity very rapidly, by about 8 years old. Would early hominids have matured in a similar fashion?
Early hominids matured pretty rapidly, on a basically ape-like schedule. And fast development has been characteristic of most hominids up to quite recent times. Even Neanderthals developed more quickly than we do.
How does the discovery and study of the Turkana boy fossil shed light on hominid development?
Well, the Tacanaboy fossil is absolutely fascinating. It's one of the most important fossils we have in the entire human fossil record.
Because this is an adolescent, so we see someone in the process of maturing?
That's exactly right. The Tacanaboy died at a chronological age of about 8 years old, but very detailed study of the microstructure of its teeth suggests that that the death was at this early stage of about 8 years. But on the other hand, as physically this individual had developed to about the same stage as a modern 12 or 13 year old.
So what is it about a long and dependent childhood that has been advantageous to humans?
Well, for human beings, the long childhood serves as a sort of apprenticeship. And it's a long period during which individuals can learn a huge amount of culture. A human being has to learn much more to function in society than a chimpanzee infant does, for example.
Theories kept on changing over the years. People arrived with preconceived theories based partly on their reading of Darwin? Or was it the early fossil? The way fossils turn up probably determines an awful lot about how we interpret our history.
That's a very good point. The human fossil record was basically discovered in inverse order. It was the most recent human precursors who were discovered first, and it took much more time to discover the very early ones. So that this has reinforced our tendency to look at everything as a sort of a step on the road to ourselves. And I think what's becoming very, very clear now is that this was not the story of human evolution was not a single-minded slog from primitiveness to perfection, but really an experimental process whereby many, many species were thrown out, and the human evolutionary tree is much more bushy than a slender tree-like.
No straight line here.
No straight line.
But that was the way – was that the evolutionary synthesis theory?
Yes. And before the Second World War, paleoanthropology was dominated by anatomists. And anatomists didn't really have much of – a human anatomist, this is to say. And they didn't have much of an awareness of the diversity in the world around them. Their preoccupations were elsewhere. And after the war, when the synthesis came along, which basically boiled down the evolutionary process to slow generation-by-generation changes in gene frequencies, the linear notion of evolution came in.
The most well-known early hominids are the Australopithecines. Mm-hmm. Lucy probably is the most famous example. Right. Can you explain what made her so important?
Well, Lucy, at the time she was discovered in 1974, was the most complete skeleton of a hominid precursor that had ever been found. Possibly 40% of the skeleton was there. Even Neanderthals, it's very rare to find a 40% complete skeleton.
They are described as a transitional genus between ape-like primates and mm-hmm. human-like primates. You suggest that explanation is a bit misleading. They are not the missing link?
Well, that's right. I think that we've got to be very careful about the terms that we use, because when we say transitional, it sort of makes them sound like a link in the chain. And in fact, these guys weren't on the way from being arboreal to fully terrestrial the way we are. They were doing their own thing. They had a body form that combined the ability to walk on the ground on two legs and to climb readily in the trees as well, and it was a life way that served them very well. It lasted for millions and millions of years.
So was it just accidental that we wound up becoming the ones to survive?
I think that
did the Ice Age play a role in that?
Well, if you look at the entire picture of human evolution, you find that typically you have several different hominid species occupying the world at any one time. And then suddenly, when Homo sapiens, and particularly modern behaving Homo sapiens, comes along at about 100,000 years to 50,000 years ago, suddenly all the competition disappears. And I'm pretty sure that that has to do with the new style of cognition that was acquired at that time. And we became basically invincible components.
Do we assume we're the only ones who develop language?
I would guess that that is the case, yes. I mean, other people seem to prefer to trace the origins of language further back into the past, but I think language was probably the thing that kicked off the modern way of processing information in the brain, and that would have been less than 100,000 years ago.
Now, we still see a lot of variation within modern Homo sapiens, both in size and color, susceptibility to disease, a wide range of things. So is this just a continuation of what we saw before?
Well, I think it's a reflection of the evolutionary process that has been going on ever since the very beginning. But I think what's really important to understand is that all this variation we see in among human beings today is an epiphenomenon of the last 50,000 years or so. Humans originated in Africa maybe 200,000 years ago, only got out of Africa about 50, 60,000 years ago. And all the variation that you find outside Africa has actually accumulated in that very short period of time.
You discuss population fragmentation, which is a result of the conditions of the Ice Age. What were the effects of small group isolation on hominid diversity?
I think that this basically is part of the explanation as to why humans came so far, so fast. Conditions during the Ice Age, fragmentation into small populations, genetically unstable populations in which genetic novelties could easily be incorporated, really facilitated the amount of evolutionary change that we see going on in the Ice Ages.
Well, there's been recent talk about the bottlenecking of the human species. What does that mean?
That means that according to the calculations of the molecular biologists who compare the DNA of modern humans, that at one point, probably in this 70 to 50,000 year range, the human population was reduced to very small indeed, from a few hundred to a few thousand individuals at most. And that in fact, you know, it was at one time during the rigors of the Ice Ages, it was a very close run thing.
So we almost disappeared?
Yep.
But now we have so much diversity. Because we spread out after that?
Yeah,
few thousand people?
Yeah, from this few hundred individuals, couple of thousand people, whatever it was, everybody else is subsequently descended.
Yeah. You explained that natural selection doesn't screen for specific traits. Why then is natural selection usually taught in those terms?
Well, natural selection is a wonderful story. And natural selection is indeed going on all the time, but it mostly, I think, acts to sort of stabilize populations and sort of trim off the extremes of the variation that's produced in each generation. Natural selection in terms of a directional force in evolution doesn't make a lot of sense when you consider that every gene is doing a lot of different jobs and that you can't focus on one system to evolve it in a particular direction. It's the whole animal that survives or perishes.
Can we assume that the process has ended with us?
I think that the rules have changed since we became a sedentary, settled species and our population mushroomed.
So natural selection doesn't apply to us?
Well, I think natural selection is still going on. It's still trimming off the extremes, as it were. But I don't think that the population as a whole, the species as a whole, is going anywhere because it's simply too large and too dense.
Thank you so much for being with us. Ian Tattersall's book, Masters of the Planet, The Search for Our Human Origins, is published by Macmillan.
Thank you.